Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Devin, and I'm really excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. Every story is the beginning of a conversation, whether it is with ourselves or with others. Across the time and culture, stories have been agents of personal transformation, in part because they have power to change our hearts and minds. The purpose of our weekly calls is to share stories from incredible change makers from around the globe. Through thoroughly guided conversations with them, our special guest speakers share their personal stories and inspire us through their actions, their experiences, and their insights. Our hope is that these conversations will plant seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society while serving to foster our own inner transformation. Behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this beautiful space. We are thankful to them and to all of our listeners for helping to co-create this space. Today, we are grateful to have remarkable guest speakers with us, Peter Kalmus, whose personal journey is not only inspiring but has had a tremendous impact on many people. Thanks again for joining today's call. Let us start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into the space. 1 minute of silence, please, before we continue our call. Thank you. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken call, today in conversation with Peter Kalmus. Here is how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Rahul Brown, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Peter Kalmus. And by the top of hour, we roll into Q&A and circle of sharing, where we invite all your reflections and questions. I have opened up the queue right now, so at any point, you can hit star 6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. In case if you are participating using live stream, you're welcome to use that form as well for submitting your thought or question. It will get to us right away and we'll be able to include that as well. Our theme today is about the climate change and what we could do about it. And our guest speaker today, it's like he's a longtime mediator and meditator, and really a very insightful question as a food for thought, Rahul, as we go along. And the question is, it's great to be mindful, but that mindfulness must also lead to emitting less carbon dioxide. Unfortunately, radiative processes in the atmosphere don't care how mindful we are. They only care how much carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases we emit. How have personal practices led to greater consciousness in your relationship to the earth and nature? And when I thought about this, Earl, the very first thought that came to me was the call that we had with Elizabeth Saitouris, I think probably about a year and a half ago. And she had developed such a beautiful context of how for us to connect with people and the whole ecosystem around us. And she had a couple of beautiful thoughts in there. And one was, we create our reality. The humanity has created massively scary situation of fear. Choose to live the life in the most positive way so you can be positive force to balance the negativity. And another thought that she had was, we need to bring down the cosmic glow, bring it not only to the heart, bring it down to the toes, fully embodied. It is there and all around. It's a matter of connecting with it instead of fear. Don't look up to angels for compassion. Bring compassion using our own physical bodies. And Rahul, when I think of compassion in context of today's theme, it's like I could think of so many ways that I could start making a small change here and there. Starting with maybe driving a better car and be a little bit more conscious of our resources. You know, what are your thoughts on today's theme?
Yeah, thank you for that, Devin. You know, I think that I really feel like this is the time when we need to see activists get spiritual and spiritual people be getting active, as Pancho likes to say. You know, last week I was at a conference in London called Extinction and Livestock. And it was this rather monumental occasion where we had the conservationists getting together in the same conference with the animal welfare people, finally coming to agreement on this idea that we sort of need to end factory farming if we want to be on a livable planet. And, I found it very hopeful. And at the same time, I'm sitting in the audience and I'm just thinking about how I basically flew to another continent to attend, and half of the people in the audience were from some other place than London and had flown in. And I was thinking about this poem that Ross Coggins wrote in 1976 called The Development Set, about how all of these people who are sort of well-meaning folks trying to solve the problems of poverty and development basically fly from fancy capital to fancy capital and are you know, in these great conferences with fantastic food. And, you know, he wonders why the problems keep getting pushed off. You know, everyone's intellectualizing and no one's actually putting these things into practice. And I think that what Peter seems to represent is this deep alignment of his understanding and his life. And, you know, we had our moments at this conference where we actually did bring that together. So I was there with Ari, who many folks in this ecosystem know as well. And right. Ari hosted a meditation session on the second morning of the conference. And we were able to bring, this remarkable tool of mindfulness to people who I think can lose sight of that in the fight towards creating a better world. So to me, it really does come down to integrating the activism with the spirituality, because that is where the alignment and integrity comes from.
So well said. It's like, be the change you wish to see in the world. And Rahul, as we get going here, a couple of really beautiful reflections that came through. And I'm going to read those right now. One is from Gwenda, and this is her share. Back in March, I started a few lines a day, being mindful of the natural world out my window, writing this in an email blog, asking others to pay attention. I witnessed birthing of 5 baby geese, the spinning of a web by a spider about the size of an eyelash, and I'm learning trees. I intend writing the head of a local grocery chain, challenging him to stop using plastic bags. And another one is from David Joran, and I'm going to read that now. I'm very conscious of our being part of the earth and nature. I don't put enough of that consciousness into personal practices. I sincerely commend you for doing so. I drive a car that gets 45 miles per diesel gallon. I hope that's an environmentally friendly action. I sign and support pro-earth and nature petitions and laws. I cut my grass less often. I run programs on our connection to the earth and cosmos to hopefully raise the consciousness of others. My practices raise my consciousness. And that last line really resonated with me. It's like you try to make the change and then change is transforming you from inside. It's like so well captured in just that one line. My practices raise my consciousness. And for all of our listeners, I know Rahul for a long, long time. He's one of our founding members of Awakening Calls and like long time volunteer with Service Space. And every time that I hear from Rahul, there is something so insightful and so simple and yet so profound comes to light. How fortunate we are to have Rahul as our moderator for today's call. So, and Rahul, if you would please introduce our speaker to all of our listeners, and if you would please guide us in conversation with Peter right now.
Thanks, Devin. So Peter Kalmus is a PhD physicist who became a climate scientist and then took the remarkable step of reorganizing his life around his understanding of the forces, both inner and outer, that contribute to climate change. In a world where climate experts and scientists zip from high-profile summit to fancy conference, spreading the urgency and alarm around the most significant disruption to occur on Earth in the last million years, Peter advocates and practices slow travel on foot, bike, train, and cars powered by waste vegetable oil. Yet, even more remarkably, he points out that while our problems appear to be technological, their roots are actually spiritual. His new book, Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution, traces his journey in aligning head, heart, and hands as he discovered the science, lifestyle changes, and meditation plus community building that not only eradicated his cognitive dissonance about how to live in our current era of climate disruption, but also awakens the deeper joy and gratitude for daily life and the preciousness of being alive. So I'm absolutely delighted to be in conversation with you today, Peter. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's an honor and a joy to be here, Rahul, and thanks, Devin.
So, Peter, you know, I've never before read a book that had gratitude for our own Sam Bauer and Pancho Ramos-Derle in the foreword, and then sort of quotes and thoughts from Ramakrishna, S.N. Goenka, Thich Nhat Hanh, and Genesis sprinkled all throughout the book. I'm just fascinated by what your journey has been. So maybe we can start there. You know, if you'd be open to sharing a little bit about how you came into this very unique perspective around climate and the way to bring about your own personal alignment with that understanding.
Right. So when I was a kid, I remember in sixth grade, sort of my first awareness of global warming began. It was mentioned in a class, by my sixth grade teacher. And I felt like this was something kind of from science fiction. It was something that was going to happen sort of in the infinite distant future, you know, 100 years later, 200 years later. So I wasn't worried about it. It didn't seem like the adults were worried about it, so I wasn't worried about it. And I kind of forgot about it. And then, you know, I kind of grew up, obviously, in the U.S., in the suburbs of Chicago. I remember, driving on the freeways or sitting on the cars when my parents were driving on the freeways and having this sort of sense that something wasn't right about that. It was, you know, ugly. It was noisy. It smelled bad. Things were moving really fast. So as a kid, I remember, you know, feeling something wasn't right about this fossil-fueled suburban way of living. I remember walking at night one time, and it was dusk, and it was beautiful, but no one else was out, and all of the houses that I passed, there was a window, and there was, like, blue light flickering out of the window, and the different windows were kind of synced up as if the different houses were watching the same station, and, it, again, I didn't think it was right, but I couldn't, at that time, I didn't have the sort of mental equipment to describe to myself what was wrong. And then I got caught up in a turmoil of sort of capitalistic competition. I moved to New York and, you know, got a job as a software engineer on Wall Street. Married my wife Sharon, and was trying to make money basically, and kind of have fun in Manhattan. And eventually, I realized if I were on my deathbed, would I feel like I lived a good life if I'd been writing software for Wall Street and helping rich people get richer? And also, I started getting really bored. So I went back to graduate school. I studied physics as a undergraduate. So I went and started working on my PhD because I wanted to be part of something greater than myself, science. So I wanted to contribute to the knowledge of humanity, basically, and be part of that adventure. And it was a great decision. You know, I really enjoyed being back in physics and learning about general relativity. And I started working for the LIGO Collaboration, which is gravitational waves. And a couple of years ago, they made their first detection. And three of the leaders of the collaboration were awarded the Nobel Prize just a few days ago. And halfway through my PhD, Al Gore's movie came out, and I saw that, and it was kind of like a bucket of cold water in my face, to be honest, because I hadn't been thinking about global warming much. And around the same time, Jim Hansen gave a physics colloquium at Columbia. So every week, you know, we would gather in this lecture hall, and there'd be a talk, often from a visiting scientist. And this time it was Jim Hansen, who probably walked up the street from the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, which is a few blocks away from Columbia. And he talked about radiative forcings. So as we add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, there's an energy imbalance where the same amount of solar radiation is coming in, so shortwave radiation from the sun, but less longwave radiation from the Earth. So any hot object is emitting energy in infrared radiation. And, you know, there has to be an energy balance on the Earth. Otherwise, the temperature will change. And then as the temperature of the planet gets warmer, it emits more infrared radiation until it's back into balance, back into energy balance. And I was sitting there listening to Dr. Hansen on the edge of my seat thinking, like, this is huge. Like, this is huge news. And everyone's kind of, like, taking it in very calmly. But I was sort of kind of jumping around inside my brain and saying, you know, we have to do something about this. And around that same time, my first son was born. So I've got two sons. And, I realized that what I was doing on this planet was far bigger than me and far bigger than my career. And my career wasn't that important. And I started thinking much further into the future, what kind of a planet are we leaving for our kids? And this became not just an intellectual exercise, but it came out of a place of deep love because, you know, up till that point, I had never felt anything like what I felt after my son was born. So that put me into kind of made me feel less kind of selfish in terms of my goals and what I was here for. After I got my PhD, I came to California, and I kept working on LIGO, but I found that I was thinking about global warming more and more and reading more papers, scientific papers on climate change, and getting very distracted from gravitational waves to the point where, you know, I started feeling like to do astrophysics right now is almost like fiddling while Rome burns. So I decided I had to shift, and this would, you know, help with that cognitive dissonance. You know, I was focused on climate change anyway, and so I had to actually kind of throw my, you know, intellectual weight into that arena and try to do what I could there. So I switched careers and became an atmospheric scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And I should say I'm speaking on my own behalf here, obviously. And around the same time, and this is the last bit of the story, I guess, this was sort of 2006 when I heard Jim Hansen and when my first son was born. I was running around in a panic, basically, saying, we got to stop burning fossil fuels. This is huge. And why doesn't anyone care about this? You know, the fate of the planet is in our hands, and we have to stop burning this stuff that we're putting in the atmosphere, and yet no one is changing at all, either individually or at the collective level. I didn't see any change happening. And I was kind of in this blind state of panic, and it was just sort of alienating my friends because it was kind of preachy and ineffective to be running around saying, we got to stop burning fossil fuels, sort of like Chicken Little, right? The sky is falling. So when I moved to California, I started gardening because, you know, Manhattan, I had a tiny apartment, and I was really disconnected from the earth. And in California, I've got this tiny yard, and it had some fruit trees. I had an avocado tree in the backyard, and it had a lemon tree, and it had space to plant more trees. So I got kind of really interested into gardening. Like, what is this soil? You know, what is this earth? What are these plants? How do I keep them happy? And I started seeing the plants as beings, and somehow that helped me realize that I had to change how I was living. That, you know, if I was worried about global warming, then, and it seems so obvious in retrospect, that I had to stop burning so much fossil fuel myself. So I shifted my focus from kind of running around and shaking people by the lapels and sort of screaming at them that they had to stop burning fossil fuels, and sort of quieted down and figured out how I could reduce fossil fuels myself. And, you know, throughout this whole time, from a few years before my son was born, so about the time I started graduate school, I started doing Vipassana meditation, and that's how I, you know, met Pancho, and through Pancho I met Sam. And I think that is kind of like the engine that allows me to not be satisfied with a dissonance, where if I have a principle, if I feel like, you know, burning fossil fuels harms others and I don't want to harm others, well, then I should do something about that. I have to actually change the way I live. What am I doing in this moment right now, right, which is contributing to that problem? And how can I change that action? You know, how can I get my food in a less harmful way? How can I travel through Altadena in a less harmful way? How can I do my science in a less harmful way without emitting all this fossil fuel, you know, without eating that factory farm meat and without, you know, contributing? So we each have a chance to put a tiny drop into one of two buckets, right? The bucket that makes the system, the prevailing sort of mainstream system that's broken and that's killing the planet. We can make that system stronger by putting our little drop in that bucket, or we can decide to put our drop in the other bucket, which is the story. You know, how can we live better in a world without fossil fuels?
Sure. That's beautiful. Thank you for taking us through that broad arc. I know that I asked you a very sort of a deep question that had many facets to it. You know, I'm curious about how you think about this dimension of personal change and systemic change, particularly in our current political environment in the United States, which isn't very favorable to a scientific-based understanding of climate and any sort of action around it. We have this sort of motif in service space where we talk about creating circles, which really end up being spaces for inner transformation. And yet it seems that these circles are sort of encased within triangles, right, which maybe are a metaphor, a motif for a hierarchical system that has created the world that we see around us. How do you think about this interplay between our ability to and our need to sort of become aware and in step with a momentum of inner transformation and its capacity then to impact the broader systems which have created the world that we live in.
So I think that I actually get some pushback from climate activists, and they'll say that, you know, you're focusing too much on individual change, and, you know, it's, we have to blame the corporations, and we have to hold them accountable, and we have to change really quickly at a systems level. And, you know, my response to that is I'm one mammal walking around in the biosphere, you know, interacting with other mammals, talking to people. I've got two hands and I've got 2 feet, and I've got one voice, you know, and I'm doing everything I can to change the collective system. But I feel like sometimes these activists who say that, they don't, I don't get a sense very often that they have a plan. Like, how, you know, how do you want to change the collective system? You know, you don't have a magic wand, right? If I had a magic wand, then I could easily change the collective system. But that's the problem of agency, right? That's the problem of being an individual in a kind of collective global society. We're up to 7.5 billion people now. That's a lot of people. So, you know, this is what's so tough about the global warming problem, is that it's easy to feel overwhelmed and it's easy to feel hopeless. I guess I always just come back to sort of to my own body and in this particular moment, you know, what can I do to make this problem better? I can write a book, for example. I can have conversations like this. I can write articles. I like writing, so that's one of the ways that I choose to kind of push for the collective change. I think that, you know, it's a political problem, but maybe even more so, it's a cultural problem. You know, and how do cultures shift? I think cultures are essentially they're just an accumulation or a collection of sort of all of our individual decisions and our individual mindsets, how we think about how to live in this world and how to interact with each other. And right now we have a fossil fuel culture, and it's hard to imagine living without fossil fuels, at least in the United States. You know, everyone's driving around, everyone's flying around. We've lived with fossil fuels, you know, with frozen foods, with shrink-wrapped meat, you know, with natural gas and electricity from coal and gas. We've lived with this stuff our whole lives. It's hard to imagine living in a different way. And that's what I discovered by reducing my own use of fossil fuel by a factor of 10, sort of step by step over a period of many years, just by saying, you know, like, okay, so here's something I'm doing today. You know, I'm driving this car, and it's emitting this much fossil fuel. And for this trip, I could actually be riding a bike, you know, and then that means I'm eating food and burning those calories to ride on this bike. And the food that I'm eating is emitting this much fossil fuel. So how can I get my food in a different way? And slowly, slowly, just by, you know, thinking about in any given moment how my action was contributing to global warming and how I could change it, I started living in a different way that to an outsider probably doesn't look that different. You know, I still coach soccer. I still work at JPL. You know, I still drive in the Los Angeles area. So I could go much further, and people have gone much further. But I guess I realized that by using a tenth of the fossil fuel, you know, I could still participate in the things that I'd been participating in that I thought were important, and I felt happier. I felt like I was living more according to my principles. It felt meaningful because this is such an urgent problem facing humanity. So from my point of view, what could be more meaningful than sort of working out, exploring, pioneering a new way of living with less fossil fuel? Maybe it's a new old way of living. And I thought that that was a message worth sharing. So that's what caused me to write the book. And, you know, I urge everyone to use their own talents and their own networks and their own sort of web of experience in their life and their own talents to tell this story in their own way. But I don't think that we can tell the story unless we're living it too. So whether you're a songwriter or an artist or a writer or a scientist or a lawyer or maybe a you know, a policymaker, a politician, whatever it is that, however you interact with the collective, you can tell a new story through that platform, through whatever. We all have a platform. We all have a channel. We all interact with other people. But to be able to tell that story, I think, requires authentically living it first. And I think that's the piece of the climate puzzle that's not happening right now. And so the culture is not shifting. And the policymakers will follow us. They'll follow the culture. So if the culture stays a fossil fuel culture, we're not going to see the change at the collective level. And that's what I keep trying to tell the activists, you know. It's not either or. You can reduce your own fossil fuel use yourself, and then you'll be able to tell the story in a much more compelling way, which will start shifting the culture and allow the collective change to happen.
Interesting. You know, the excuse that I think the traditional folks in the climate space have is that their use of fossil fuels in a way is what allows them to sort of scale the reach of their message, right? I mean, this is why people fly from Paris to Rio to, you know, San Francisco, giving talks, etc. How have they been receptive to this idea, which I think you're sharing, around sort of a different theory of change, really one around sort of authentically living one's understanding so that you can allow that culture to shift?
Well, there's some, you know, some activists and scientists, climate activists, authors who have really big platforms. People like Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein, Michael Mann, and they're doing fantastic work, and I'm grateful for their work. I often wonder what would happen if one of them decided to reduce his or her own fossil fuel use by a factor of 10 and to, you know, make it known that they were doing this, and to stop flying, say, you know what, I'd love to come to that conference, but I don't want to do the flight, so if we can do a phone call or, you know, video conferencing, then I'll attend. I mean, these are people that are already really well known. They already have kind of this network of kind of face-to-face interactions under their belt. I'm not sure how much they would, their mission would be impacted if they stopped flying around. And I kind of wonder if it would be a huge boost to their message. So this is kind of an open experiment. I've tried to start, there are a few climate scientists who don't fly anymore and who try to reduce their own emissions. You would think that, you know, every climate scientist would do that because we're on the front lines. We kind of see the Earth system changing before anyone else does. That's one thing that scientists love about doing science is, you know, you get a result and you have a little piece of knowledge before any of those 7.5 other billion people have it, and then you publish it. And that's kind of how the, you know, science is the cutting edge of human knowledge. That's how it moves forward. But you would think that front row seat would have a lot of influence on climate scientists and cause us to stop burning fossil fuels. But I think there's so much cognitive dissonance sort of built into the default structure of the human mind that it's very easy for humans to kind of have intellectual knowledge and then to live in a way that's not in accordance, like live irrationally. And the climate scientists, I think, are doing that just as much as any other human, maybe not quite as much as other humans, but I think they rationalize and say, well, you know, we need to fly around to do this work, and therefore it's worth it. But there are a few. I have a website called noflyclimateside.org, and I'm trying to collect anecdotes from climate scientists and from other academics who are either have stopped flying or who are trying to fly less. One thing I should say is that in 2010, when I was reducing my emissions, the first thing I did was to quantify them, to just estimate, you know, from seven areas of my life, what emissions were rising from each of those seven areas. So from the stuff that I buy, from the food that I eat, electricity, natural gas, flying, driving, and then throwing things away, waste. So flying was three quarters of my emissions. In 2010, I was flying to conferences and collaboration meetings. Maybe it was, I think it was around 50,000 miles a year. And that was three quarters of my emissions. And that's very common, I think, for scientists and other academics. So that's sort of a leverage point. You know, if we want to start shifting the culture, you know, I think the scientific community would become a much stronger lever in shifting the culture if we started walking the walk a little bit more. The public would say, you know, they're actually concerned enough about this to be making these changes. Otherwise, the public might say, well, the scientists know the most about this problem, and they don't seem concerned. They're not changing, so it's probably not that bad. So I'd love to see more thought leaders on climate start actually walking the walk. I don't know how effective that'll be, but I think it's an experiment that hasn't been done yet, and, you know, I'm hopeful that it could have some sort of impact.
Sure. What do you think about the thought that we may have some kind of a technological fix that can get us out of this extreme climate danger? You know, there's that famous quote by Buckminster Fuller who said that the way that we sort of change the status quo is to invent a new status quo that makes the current system obsolete. And, you know, there's some sort of hopeful things on the horizon, which I think technology is always great at sort of giving us some hope for a horizon. For instance, around travel, the notion of kind of virtual reality or blended augmented reality is one that potentially can eliminate a lot of that. And then around, say food, right? I mean, meat has a huge disproportionate impact on our climate emissions than plant-based foods. And we sort of we're in this dawn of the era of plant-based meats and clean meat, which is basically cellulosic meat that is grown in the lab with a small number of stem cells at a fraction of the resource and without killing any animals. So, I mean, what do you think about this notion that we can invent our way out of climate catastrophe?
Right, that's a great question, Raul. So, I think that we have to understand that climate change is actually a symptom. Climate change isn't actually the root problem. It's just the most urgent symptom of the root problem, which is in our minds. It's how we think about our place on this earth. Recently I've come more and more to think that, you know, we're not, as a society, we're not happy. You know, we're running around, we're stressed out, people are taking antidepressants, people are self-medicating and abusing substances. You know, we're not connecting with each other. We're on our devices all the time. I think there's this unhappiness, this disease in our society, I think is closely related to the symptom of that we're seeing of global warming, which is the most urgent symptom right now. The thing that, you know, thing that's going to cause the most suffering, maybe in the short term. The technological fix won't get to the root of this problem. It can kick the can down the road a little bit, and it can maybe reduce our emissions, but you know, we have to go deeper. Something else will come up. I mean, the population is still growing. Habitat loss is continuing apace. There's only half as many wild animals alive now as there were 30 years ago when I was a kid. Sixth extinction event is ongoing. The rate of extinctions right now is 1,000 times beyond the background rate, and it's accelerating. And global warming is... you know, kind of, there's a race between global warming and habitat loss in terms of, you know, extinguishing a lot of the beautiful, amazing species on this planet. and global warming is getting stronger and stronger in that race. So I was thinking the other day, I was riding my bike and thinking what is happiness and what gives rise to happiness? And then three things popped into my mind. The first one was gratitude. I think that there have been a lot of human cultures on this planet, and most of them couldn't just go to the supermarket and, you know, buy food and bring it home and then sort of eat it in front of the television. So it was a little harder to get food. And because of that, I think gratitude was woven into their culture, and they were very grateful for their food. They were grateful for each other and the support from their communities. This was part of kind of their worldview. I guess you could call it their religion. Thanksgiving was a real thing for them. And I was thinking that without gratitude, I can't be happy. This was what I was thinking when I was riding my bike. And then the second thing that I was thinking was, I can't be happy if I'm not living in a way that's aligned with my deeper principles, because I just can't fool myself. And then the last thing was breath. You know, at the time I was on my bike, and I was kind of working hard and using my body, and took a breath in and just felt like, wow, you know, this, what an amazing planet that I can be on the surface of it, this rock like kind of whizzing through space and breathe in this, you know, beautiful breath of fresh air. So, you know, where am I going with this? Well, technology, we tend to not want to change, and I'm not sure why. That's such a strong part of being human, is kind of resisting change, because change is the reality. We're always constantly changing. But, you know, I find that by kind of observing reality and then thinking about how, what's causing me to suffer and how can I change, is actually a wonderful opportunity for kind of reducing that suffering and becoming happier. But our resistance to change is causing us to sort of seek a technological fix, a techno fix for this problem. I also think that in our society, a lot of our meaning, religion isn't a big part of our society anymore. And the human mind needs to feel like it's part of something bigger. It needs meaning. So I think this sense of progress, of human progress and technological progress, and you know, these ideas that come from science fiction, sort of a substitute for that sense of meaning. Like if we're not having progress, then I think you know, people feel like maybe somehow life is less meaningful. So they want that techno fix for all of these reasons. In terms of the global warming symptom, I think we have to work with the technologies that we have. We can't count on something that doesn't even exist now to save us, because it's, you know, climate change is here now. We don't have decades left to fool around with hoping for a techno fix. So basically renewables is what we have. That's the main thing. And if we, just to speak in practical terms, if we meet renewables halfway, say for example, if we had policies that caused us to use half the electricity in the United States, we would only need to build a quarter of the renewables to completely decarbonize our electric grid. And so building a quarter of, you know, would that's huge, right? To only have to build a quarter instead of four times as much. So in terms of just dealing with the carbon, I really hope that we start learning how to meet the renewable energy technology halfway by using less.
What stood out to me was I really loved your answer around how you define happiness as gratitude, alignment with our inner principles and understanding, and then breath, which I thought was remarkable. So, you know, like, I want to get that, drive a little deeper at your understanding of the root of this problem, because the way I heard you express it was that it's our unhappiness that's at the root of the climate change problem, and climate change is simply the symptom of that unhappiness.
Right.
I wonder if there are perhaps sort of other roots. You know, it's not like a single root, but that perhaps this idea of speciesism, you know, the idea that humans are some exceptional and separate part of exceptional beings, not part of nature, and therefore, you know, we don't have even an intellectual feeling of our interconnection with other life, much less a visceral feeling. So I think that's one strand of my question: is that are there multiple roots to this problem in your thinking that are at the root? And if indeed it is sort of our unhappiness, it feels like this question of unhappiness is sort of an age-old problem. It's a timeless problem that isn't new to the modern era. We may have sort of exacerbated it in some ways through greater disconnection, but that it's something that, you know, like the Buddha said, suffering is there, right? It's just part of our existence. So what's, you know, how do we address it if it's something that's always there?
Yeah, great questions. Wow, where to begin? Maybe a better word for something deeply at the root of our predicament instead of unhappiness might be wanting. But I think they're kind of...
Say that again? What was that word?
Wanting. So desire. Wanting things.
Wanting. Desire. Yeah, okay.
But I think they're sort of synonymous. If you think about what desire is, what wanting is, it's a dissatisfaction with the present moment, with what you have now. It means you're not satisfied. You know, it's these words, you know, they come with a lot of baggage, you know, so you can say you're not happy, but someone thinks about happiness as sort of like a superficial thing. But anyway, however you want to say it, dissatisfaction, unhappiness, this suffering, this wanting means that something's wrong now and you're not in the present moment, but instead you're thinking about the future and you're hoping that if something can come in and fill this lack that you're feeling, then you'll be happy. So it's always like pushing off this happiness into the future and kind of by definition not being present right now. You know, so I think that this is why I love Vipassana meditation so much. It's a path that helps me, you know, learn to stop wanting so much all the time, and to be more satisfied with what I have right here and right now and what's right in front of me, and to be more present with that. That comes, you know, that is the teachings of the Buddha. It comes from sitting and experiencing change in the framework of your own mind and your own body. So there's probably a lot of meditators on the call now, and I probably don't have to go that in depth with this, but once you experience change kind of at the atomic level in your matter, and you can feel that there's really not any solidity in your body, and you can feel the experience the thoughts coming and going and sort of go to a place that's beyond those thoughts, and start to realize that this whole concept of self really is an illusion, and that's not just some kind of like, you know, thing that the Buddha says or things that, you know, mystical people say, but it's actually just a sort of, you know, very kind of earthy reality. It's not something that's mystical. It's just a fact that, you know, there's no solidity and that this notion of self is an illusion. Then your attachment to that notion of self decreases because it doesn't make sense to be attached to something that isn't really there. And that kind of opens your kind of whole being in a certain way to breaking down that sense of separateness, that sense that you're different from other people, that it's a zero-sum game, that you're in competition. It starts breaking down the fear of death, which is so rampant in our society and causes all this hoarding and all this fear and people, you know, going out and buying guns and being afraid and wanting to put up walls and so forth. I think a lot of that comes from a fear of death. So, you know, that's a very good path that works for me. I think that there's other paths to sort of start to experience that kind of breakdown of this sense of solidity and sort of the dissolution of the ego. Some people find it by being in nature. I remember when I was a teenager, I had a really kind of profound experience when I was building trail in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains as part of a trail crew with the Boy Scouts. And we've been building trail day after day. I've been sledging at these rocks to break the rocks down and to make a trail go through the wilderness. And, you know, late at night, I got up out of my tent because I had to pee, and there was a beautiful moon. You know, the light was filtering through the trees. And I walked out half a mile to the trail that I'd been working on that day, and I just lay there and looked up at the stars and had this, you know, the same sort of sense of dissolution and being, you know, a small part of something much bigger in a very good way. So I think there are multiple paths. The problem here is, I think if everyone could experience this sort of dissolution, maybe we wouldn't have a lot of the problems that we have. But it's a slow path, and it's a lifelong path. And I think it takes, even to be attracted to that, to be willing to sit and meditate instead of moving around fast all the time and distracting ourselves. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people that wouldn't want to even kind of start down that path. So I'm not saying that this is a solution to climate change, but, you know, we all have our time here on this planet, and we can choose how to spend it. And I guess I'm kind of an idealist because, you know, there's nothing. So as a physicist, you know, as someone who's been trained in physics, there's no law of physics that says we have to have wars on this planet, or that, you know, we have to have factory farming, or that we have to have global warming, or that even that, you know, we have to fight within our families. And you know, we could live harmoniously if we did that sort of spiritual work. So at least, you know, I've decided that as long as I'm here, I'm going to try to go down that path. No, these answers are sort of long, and I hope that's okay, because you're asking such good questions. So you raised this question of speciesism, and I think that's right on the money too. And I think that's another path towards this dissolution of the self. Somehow, this single culture, global warming is not really human. It's not the fault of humans. It's the fault of one human culture, which decided that, you know, it had this right to conquer, this dominion over all that crawls on the land and all that swims in the sea, you know, and all of the plants are here to serve this one species, us, and that there's something very special about us. That's such a destructive mentality. That's the mentality of separation. And there have been lots of cultures on this planet, and there are lots of cultures on this planet now that don't have that worldview and do see humanity as one thread in this larger web of life. And I think that's such a beautiful worldview to me. It's to me, so much more comforting to feel like one thread in a web of life. You know, it's such a beautiful thing, this web of life, and to sort of set ourselves apart from it and disconnect from it and disconnect from our food sources, we're missing out on, I mean, to have the worldview of being in the web of life is to be like a child on this, in this wonderland of miracles, right? I remember what it was like being a kid and looking at ants really closely and looking at other insects and looking at rocks and looking at roots under the soil, you know, and as adults, we don't tend to do that in this culture. But I mean, also speaking as a physicist, it's just a miracle that we have this rock, which is coated with this amazing abundance of life, this kind of psychedelic explosion of plants and animals and bacteria and you know, mushrooms and fungi, and it's amazing to not walk on this earth with that sense of wonder is such a sad thing. And you know, I think a lot of that comes from that disconnection comes from this speciesism. So to be the conqueror is to suffer, I think.
Beautifully said.
Wow. So, Raul, if I may interject before we get to your next question, to all of our callers, if you would like to share a thought or ask a question, when you press star 6 on your phone, it will get you in the queue. And I see that we actually have one caller in the queue already. You're welcome to email us questions at ask@servicespace.org. It's ask@servicespace.org. Or when you complete the form that is in our live streaming interface, the question will come to us immediately as well. And so, Rahul, I didn't mean to interject, so maybe go with your next question, and then we get to a caller that is in the queue. So, thank you.
Sure. You know, Peter, I you know, you were asking if your long answers were okay, and I just love them. So, no need to sort of abbreviate. And I sort of feel like I could be in conversation with you for hours, and certainly hope to continue our conversation after this call at a future date. And again, I have so many questions that I could ask.
We could have a lightning round now.
Okay, sure. Okay, so, you know, one question is, you know, you shared about how becoming a father really increased your urgency around doing this work and diving into the climate world, shifting from physics, because of that deep love that you felt. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that phenomenon broadly for the people out there who care about the issue but are not yet parents, especially given this idea that, in a way, it's you know, our kids. You know, and I have two kids myself, and this was very much on my mind also when I was bringing them into the world, but just this idea that we're bringing children into a very dire reality. The potential for a very dire reality, which is unfolding around us at this very moment. And in a way, it's actually the impact of a kid in the West is just many orders of magnitude more than a kid in the places where population may be growing more broadly. And yet, much like it did this for you, you know, having a child made climate action much more urgent for me as well. So what do you say about that paradox between sort of the urgency informed by a love for this being and the resource impact of this new being as well?
Yeah, so, you know, having two kids now, I would say that somehow I see all of the, in some sense, not to sound too corny, but all of the plants and animals on this planet and all of the other children kind of as my children now too, in a sense. And I try to speak for the beings that don't have a voice. So the kids that don't exist, the kids that are very young now, and then of course all the other non-human, other than human beings on this planet. But yeah, it's a tough problem. I think that maybe one of the key missing ingredients in activism right now is love. I think a lot of activism comes out of the sense of anger and maybe the sense of fear or the sense of panic. But I think it might be more effective if it comes out of a sense of deep love. I, you know, I had to go through this process of grief when I fully understood the implications of global warming. When I started to fully understand them, it kind of hit me like like the loss of a dear loved one, because of this love for, you know, all of the beings on this planet, you know, I cried a lot, and it still hits me sometimes. I was doing a book event. It was the first book event I did, and I was reading a passage about the loss of species on this planet, and I actually started crying during, you know, like there were 60 people in the audience, and I had to, like, take a moment, you know. So it can hit me in unexpected times. I called my congressional representative's office once to talk about a California bill, and I started it was about a climate bill, and I started explaining how kind of we need this for our kids, and I started crying when I was on the phone with this representative, which was a huge surprise to me, you know, because it's such a business-like call. And I think a lot of the activists that I respect the most, I know have gone through a similar sense of grief. I've talked about this with, you know, Ethan Hughes at the Possibility Alliance and Chris Moore Bachman, who has a wonderful book out called The Gandhian Iceberg. And they've, mm-hmm. they've experienced this kind of level mm-hmm. of grief. So grief comes from a place of love. It's a sense of loss of something that you love dearly. So it's very different emotion than despair, if you think about it. Grief is this, it's sort of a constructive emotion that makes love grow exponentially in your heart. And so, you know, as soon as the tears stop crying, it makes you want to start working as hard as you can to save what's left. And I think it really did for me take having kids to bring me to that sort of emotional maturity. And it's not clear how, I don't really have an answer on how people can do that without having kids. I'm sure it's possible, and I'm sure that probably a lot of listeners without kids have gone through that stage of grief. But, you know, for me, that was having the kids kind of really pushed me into that and forced me to deal with it.
Sure. Hmm. Devin, did you want to go to Aria's question?
What's that?
Yes, sir. Rahul and Peter, if I may, so we have Aria in the queue. And so for all of our speakers, when you start, if you'd please tell us your name and where you're calling from. So here is our first share of question.
Hi, this is Aria in Half Moon Bay. Thank you so much, Peter. I'm really feeling inspired listening to you, and thank you, Rahul, and thank you, Devin. So here's my question, Peter. A while ago, a few of us in service space were having a conversation about the issue that you were talking about earlier on, which is, on the one hand, there's systemic action. On the other hand, there's sort of small, doable personal actions that ordinary people can take. The idea that was getting envisioned was, what if a few people could get together and create a website and an app which would give any ordinary person a kind of personal dashboard with choices about what can I do as an ordinary person to reduce my carbon footprint. You know, maybe if I'm a meat eater, I'll cut down on the number of meat meals I eat, or maybe I'll take a bike to work one day a week, or maybe I'll change the light bulbs in my house, you know, various small steps I could take. And then what if people like you who are climate scientists could be involved in creating algorithms that would say, you know, if 100 million people would do the same thing, what would be the impact on the planet? And allow ordinary people everywhere to sort of figure out what personal choices they would make, and maybe collect the data and provide feedback loops and encourage lots of people to do that, so that you've got both changing yourself and changing the world. And I'm wondering if you have come across any projects like this and what your thoughts about it would be.
I think it sounds like a great idea. And I'd be willing to collaborate on something like that and do the experiment. So I think of all of these things as experiments, and you don't know how effective they're going to be until you try them. But, yeah, I'd encourage you to contact me offline, and we can discuss it further. I think that my own path required kind of taking sort of personal responsibility. So I tried, this back in 2010, I tried going online and using the existing carbon calculators and somehow found it not satisfying because it would sort of give me a survey and I'd answer all the questions and it would spit me back like a bunch of suggestions. And somehow it didn't personally speak to me. I think it might work for some people. What did work for me was doing the research myself kind of and figuring out. And so I walk through this in my book and go in lots of detail into where the emissions come from. And, you know, like, you know, a gallon of gasoline burning it emits this much carbon dioxide. But then there's, you know, approximately 20% overhead from just getting the oil out of the ground. And that's growing as, you know, it becomes harder to get the oil. But you know, going into that research and then kind of tailoring it to my own life was helpful for me. But I think that an app, one of the things that would be really useful is that it would help, it would help track things over time. You know, people could, you know, maybe, I don't know if you could even tie it into people's utility bills and stuff like that. But they could, you know, maybe every couple of months or whenever they feel like it, they could, you know, say like how much gas they're burning, how much they're flying. And then it could make the plot the graphs for them, you know, and maybe sort of use that to touch off some kind of a conversation with their friends and with their colleagues. And maybe, you know, I do think of the actual emissions reduction, you know, becoming vegetarian, biking more, composting, which causes the food waste to not turn into methane when it goes in the landfill, it turns into methane. And there's dozens of little things like this. Some of them are bigger for me. Some of them are smaller. Some of the things that are really reduce my emissions a lot wouldn't reduce someone else's a lot and vice versa. So I think it is kind of like a game over the course of years as I decreased, it was a lot of fun. And so I think if an app sort of brought that aspect of it out, it could actually be very useful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking that, not everybody can be a Peter or a Poncho and, you know, reduce your carbon by 90%. But if I'm just a lone person by myself and I'm going to take a little step, then maybe I feel like I'm not doing very much and it's not going to have an impact. But if technology can provide me a way to see how this could have an impact if lots of people do it and to see all of us what we're doing, and I can feel part of something larger, then, you know, it might motivate me to get started and start taking small steps and then maybe take bigger steps.
Well, that's right. And one thing that I love about it, too, is that it pulls in this notion of quantifying our actions, which I think has been a huge missing piece in the mainstream environmental movement. There's all these, you know, online articles about, you know, 10 things you can do for the climate, you know, 15 ways to reduce your footprint. And they're just kind of a grab bag. Some of the things are maybe significant and some of them are so minor as to be insignificant. And I think not selecting between the bigger things and the smaller things, not quantifying, sort of causes noise to be added to the discussion, sort of noise and confusion. So I think an app like what you're suggesting would make it very clear to someone, like, oh, you know, this thing I just did was huge, you know, cut out, you know, 15% of my footprint, or this thing I did didn't even show up because it was, you know, unplugging my cell phone charger. It was such a small thing. So I think you're right. And Ethan Hughes says, and I totally agree with him, that, you know, if any atom is moving in the right direction instead of the wrong direction, that's a good thing.
Thanks, Peter. So I'll follow up offline.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, every small bit counts, and I love the thought that if there is a way to quantify that I did this much for my environment today, that would be awesome. Thank you, Arya, for your question and very well, beautifully shared thoughts around that as well. Let me get to our next caller right now. And again, if you would please share your name and where you're calling from.
Good morning. This is Kozo from Cupertino. Thank you, Peter, Rahul, Devin. This is a beautiful conversation, an important conversation. Peter, you remind me of one of my favorite childhood characters, the Lorax. You know, I'm the Lorax. I speak for the trees. So it's a beautiful to see an embodiment of that.
Yeah, I feel like that sometimes.
Yeah, like nobody's listening.
Yeah.
When I first came across your work in when I heard you were going to be an Awaken Call guest, and I read about the air travel, it was like one of the best things I've ever heard and one of the worst things I've ever heard, right? Because I was like, why did I have to hear this? Because my family's from Hawaii, and I'm like, I might never go back to Hawaii again, And so I shared it with so many people in my circle, whether it's, parents of kids who my kids play with, or family members, or close personal friends. And I told them, basically that same story that, 3/4 of carbon footprint if you just take a flight to Hawaii. And it's amazing how many people were like, wow, that's amazing. Wow, 3/4, really? And then the next day they'd be like, hey, Kozo, I'm flying to Japan. Do you think, but I have a double layover that's $1,000 less. Should I take that or should I go the faster flight? And in fact, I was late to this call this morning because my wife flew to New York at 4:00 in the morning. So I had to drive her there. So I slept through the beginning of this call. And I'm just in awe I'm surprised by the people who hear it and then just are like, oh, 3/4 of our carbon footprint. Oh, yeah, but I'm still gonna fly to Turkey tomorrow. And I'm sure you come across that with the climate scientists, right? Who are flying to these events across the world. And I'm wondering, how do you see that fitting into the larger picture? Is it that it's going to just take a few small committed individuals to make a large change? The market meet. Model, or is it that apathy is going to have to, people can be apathetic for so long until, they start seeing the traumatic events that are happening now. And I'm just curious about what your vision of the larger picture is in relation to that apathy.
Yeah, I think it's both of those things. And I think that the apathy comes from being able to kind of sever the sort of causal connection between the flights and these disasters that are happening and causing suffering, like the fires right now in Santa Rosa. The way it worked for me was it took me a couple of years to ramp down my flying. I remember my last flight was to a collaboration meeting in Rome, actually. And I was sitting on the plane and I felt like I don't want to be here because I know the harm and I don't want to cause that harm. And going to hang out with my friends, my scientific friends in Rome, and give this little update on my work wasn't worth the damage that it was doing. So I think we need, as a culture, to start recognizing that burning fossil fuels actually causes harm. That getting on that flight is not too different from, running up to somebody a stranger on the street and punching him in the face. That's not socially acceptable, but somehow burning fossil fuels still is socially acceptable. And then, it does increase the likelihood of having fires. It does increase the likelihood of catastrophic flooding. None of those, we had those kinds of events before climate change, but now the suffering and the amount of people that are affected by it is much greater because the likelihood and the severity of those kinds of events is increasing, and that's quite well known. So to me, the cause and effect was very clear, and I just realized, I don't feel good. I don't want to be on this flight, and that was kind of the key thing for me. And so, again, if that cognitive dissonance somehow isn't tunneled through, then people are probably going to keep flying. There's one more piece, but as more of us stop doing it and speaking out about the damage that it's doing, that helps other people tunnel through that cognitive dissonance, because I think the cognitive dissonance comes from sort of the cultural normalization. Like, we see everyone else doing it, and so it must be okay. And so as more and more people say, no, it's not okay, and I'm not doing it anymore, then it becomes, we start saying, oh, well, I guess there's alternatives, and I guess this is harmful, and we think twice. I know a lot of my personal friends who are very close to me, I was surprised by this. I didn't actually think writing this book and speaking out would cause almost all of the people that are in direct contact with me to start changing in certain ways and to start reducing and to think twice about taking that flight. So they haven't like stopped flying, but they're flying less and they're being more mindful. And it you know, remember, it took me 2 years to ramp down my flying. So it's not something that people are going to do overnight. And then the final piece, the third piece is, I do think we need a price on carbon emissions. I think that it's a tragedy of our market system right now that burning fossil fuels is causing this huge harm across the globe. And you could put cost to that harm, I guess. And that harm's, it's not the new normal because it's getting worse, and it's going to get worse and worse until we stop burning the fossil fuels. And yet we're not paying more for that dubious privilege, you know, in quotations, to use the atmosphere as an open sewer and to emit that carbon dioxide, which is causing all this harm. So we need to make that more expensive, and that will cause people who still have the cognitive dissonance and the you know, institutions that send people on business trips that push academics to fly, all these institutional sort of reasons, that will start to decrease because flying will just get more expensive.
Devin, if it's okay, I have a follow-up question.
Sure, great.
Peter, one of the things that allowed me to get over that cognitive dissonance is, and to act immediately is, my family's from Hawaii, and, you know, the Hawaii state motto is Huomau Ke Oka Aina I Ka Pono. It means, the life of the land, or the life of that which sustains us, will not survive if we aren't pono, if we aren't in alignment, if we aren't righteous, if we aren't good, you know? And so there's like a direct, responsibility if you're from Hawaii to sustain the land, right? And it's about what you do, you being pono, you being righteous. And I'm wondering if you've seen this happening, or if you've explored this at all, if indigenous wisdom is offering a solution to climate change that technology is not. You know, like Rahul asked a question about technology.
Yeah, thank you so much for that follow-up question. I strongly, strongly feel that that's true. I'm actually reading a book right now called Braiding Sweetgrass, which is by a botanist who is also, you know, an indigenous person from the Potawatomi tribe. And it's amazing, you know, how these indigenous people, these other cultures, which I mentioned briefly earlier in the call, they've been saying this consistently from the beginning, and our culture hasn't been listening. And they're all saying the same thing. They're all saying that, you know, this is our mother. This land is what gives us life. You know, the land owns us. We don't own the land, and we need to have gratitude for it. Otherwise, these gifts go away. You know, what I think a lot of what these, I still have a lot of learning to do about this subject, but it seems that sort of one thing that we get so many gifts from the land. I mean, the air that we breathe, the food that we eat, and not only that, but the fact that we're not responsible for our own bodies. I'm always blown away by that. The, you know, billions of years of evolution led to the plans that cause us to exist, you know, in our ancestry, like going back to not just to humans, but even to before humans. So the biosphere really is our mother. The earth really, literally is our mother. And all of these gifts, the gift of life itself that come from this dear mother, our job maybe is what we give in return is maybe simply gratitude. And that's missing in our culture. We've replaced it with love of money, with, you know, with this desire for hoarding and profit and for taking as much as we can. And these, like your people in Hawaii and these other indigenous people, the act of gratitude, this sense of gratitude means in practice only taking what you need and feeling grateful for it and sharing it with others, not just humans, but other than humans too. So yeah, great point. So one thing that's challenging is when you say these things, these kinds of ideas, to this dominant sort of industrial culture of separation, people immediately say, oh, you want us to live like cavemen. You know, you want us to go back in time. And that's that, you know, myth of progress, you know, progress, technological progress as the source of meaning in our lives that I was mentioning earlier. And we have to shatter that mindset. And there is no going back. Everything is going forward. Time goes in one direction. But I hope that we learn to, our culture has very little wisdom. And these other cultures had their own technology, but it was a wise, I think they had more wisdom. I'll come out and say it. And I hope that some of our technological innovations from this particular culture are good. But I hope that we can have more, I would like to see us have more wisdom going forward in how we decide which ones we're going to keep and how we're going to use them.
Beautiful. Real quick, in relation to braiding sweetgrass, I had a very similar moment, Peter, where I read my sons are 10 and 7, I read them that story of Sky Woman and Turtle Island, and I started crying while I was reading it to them, you know, when the muskrat brings up the last bit of mud. And they were, I mean, that made them really engaged, right? Like, this is an important story. And I encourage everyone who's out there, if you have children, get Braiding Sweetgrass and just read them the first chapter. Read them the Sky Woman story, because that shifts, the fundamental shift in how we view the land as opposed to the Adam and Eve story. So, yeah, obviously I'm like Rahul. I could talk to you for hours. So thank you. Thank you, Peter. Thank you for all you're doing.
Yeah, I'm so glad you raised that point. I cried at certain points too, especially when she was trying to learn the language, and there were seven elders in the teepee. They were the last people on the planet who spoke that language, and they were telling jokes in the language and laughing to each other and then trying to explain the jokes in English. But just the loss of a language, the loss of a culture, that was maybe the first time I actually cried at that that notion, which is, in some sense, to me, more horrifying than the loss of any individual.
Wow, how insightful. Thank you, Kozo, for your sharing your questions. And Peter, we have one more share that came over email, and it is from one of my all-time favorite service spaces, Misha Rosen. Let me read Misha's share. And Peter, it is for all of us. Hello, Peter, Rahul, Devin, and all on this call today. What do you say to those who deny climate change? I'm at a loss when I find myself engaged in conversation with one. I don't have children and do find myself in tears often at the current state of our planet. I converse with many who are in deep grief and feeling helpless right now, and are in need of encouragement. Dealing with daily discouragement and disbelief over the environmental reversals Trump is curving. How do you encourage others? Thank you for who you are. Grateful and gratitude, Mish. And Mish is from Brooklyn, New York.
Right. Okay, great question. So I think there's sort of two kinds of what we could call climate deniers. There's those who are sort of denying essentially in good faith. They don't know, or, you know, their tribe, the people that they listen to are deniers, so they're deniers too. But they're not sort of denying in a cynical way. So the other kind are people who are, you know, stand to gain from not acting on climate change. So people, you know, in the oil industry, politicians that take money from the oil industry and so forth. So there's two different kinds. The first kind, I think the way to, if you're interacting with them, is to listen a lot and to explain, you know, when they're ready to listen, but not to hit them over the head. So my father was a climate denier, and over the course of 10 years of maybe talking to him an hour a week, he's now a huge advocate for action on climate. He's not an activist, but he believes we should strongly, that it's urgent and that we need to act on climate. But that's the level, in my experience, of how much work it takes to change the mind of that first kind of denier. The second kind, if they're not discussing in good faith and they're just trying to spread lies and spread misinformation, I think it's important for scientists, for example, to put the correct information out there as much as possible, because otherwise right. there's a vacuum and they step into it and they cause so much confusion because they cause the first kind of climate deniers to exist. But you're not going to change their minds. I don't see how you can do that. And so to try to engage with them directly is probably playing into their game and is possibly counterproductive. And I would suggest not spending your limited time and energy trying to persuade them that climate change is real. And I'll say one last thing, which is the energy I try to, the way I try to spend my energy mostly is a third class of, they're not exactly climate deniers, but they're sort of, they know, they're sort of the NPR intellectuals who drive Priuses, and of which I was one before I went through my process of grief and started and had my first kid. You know, I was sort of like that, and I thought I was doing my part, you know, recycling. And I think that there's a lot of space to try to get those people whose hearts are in the right place but whose hands aren't really doing very much, and maybe who haven't gone very far down the spiritual path, discussions with them might be the most fruitful of all, because there's so few people that are kind of walking the walk and really pushing hard for action. And the potential for getting more of those kinds of really strong voices and really strong actors lies in that large pool of kind of, I guess you could call it maybe like sort of apathetic progressives. So I think that's a great place to spend one's time and energy.
Yeah, I mean, how well put together, just talk to people around you and start developing that awareness and mindset and this consciousness, and that can lead to so many good things.
Yeah.
So I know there are more Christians probably, Peter, if any of our callers or any of our volunteers would like to ask you more questions, can we use your email address to send you the questions that
absolutely.
We have?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And listeners can contact me directly through, there's a contact form on the book's webpage. So you can go to beingthechangebook.com and then send me.
Beingthechangebook.com. Okay.
Yeah. And I have a personal website, too, that you can probably find just by Googling me, and it also has a contact form. So, yeah, I encourage listeners to contact me directly or through Service Space, and I'd love to continue the conversation. I really enjoyed this.
Right, and I know that we are beyond our mark here. Peter, if I may just take a couple of more minutes here. We always like to ask this question to our callers, and so as all of us Service Space volunteers, like our ecosystem, how can we help you in this beautiful journey and such an impactful, insightful endeavor that you are on? How can we help you?
Oh, great question. A little bit of a surprise. Well, so I spent 5 years writing this book, and I don't want to make any profits from it. I want to any profits I do make, I want to donate to groups that work towards connecting individual action toward collective action. So kind of bridging that gap and increasing people's personal agency. Groups like Citizens Climate Lobby and Our Children's Trust. So I don't want to make any money, but it's hard to get the word out for the book. So spread the word for the book. Get the book if you like it. Try to get other people to get it and get the word out there, because that's, I poured my heart and soul into it. And so that's sort of like having a conversation with me. And then the other thing, if you have ideas for how to use your personal kind of wisdom and your own individual talent to cause people to get it to the level that they sort of feel this emotionally, not just intellectually, and then actually start reducing their emissions, then do that. Take the initiative. Find your own path. You'll write your own book. Write your own song. run for office, you know, do all of those things that are your calling, you know, find your calling and do everything you can, because this is the urgent crisis for humanity, and we can make a better world. We can make a world where we think differently and we connect with each other better and we fight less and we're happier.
How inspiring. With Service Space, we go back to Mahatma Gandhiji's one-liner so many times, like, be the change you wish to see in the world. And the change here could really be just start doing small bits and start making a difference in your own small way. And every small bit counts, and before you know it, it can start developing that consciousness around you, and you could be part of the change. So how insightful, and so many stories and so many thoughts that came and so many reflections came before the call as well. So how grateful we are for all of this. And so you would like to have a minute of silence, a minute of gratitude before we wrap up this call. So 1 minute of silence, please. Again, how grateful we are for thoughtfulness and depth of reflections and such a profound message in stories that are shared today. I'm going to unmute all of us, all of our callers right now. And so on my count of three after that, let's all of us just say thank you, Peter. I'm going to unmute, and then on my count of three, one, two, three.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.